Yes, America's Anchorman is away, and this is your undocumented Anchorman sitting in direct from northern New Hampshire via the miracle of technology. It goes from Ice Station EIB up here in New Hampshire all the way down to Mr. Snerdley at EIB Southern Command in Florida, then up to New York, over to Los Angeles, up to the satellite, and from the satellite to the world. It is an amazing technological feat, and it's a great privilege to be with you on the second day of our broadcasts from Ice Station EIB. The great Walter E. Williams will join us in the next hour to talk about his new book. This is our last live show of the year 2010. We'll have a best of Rush for New Year's Eve tomorrow. I'll be here Monday, and Rush returns to start another year of excellence in broadcasting live this Tuesday. I used the George Orwell phrase about an hour ago, the pansy left. And I think that's a good way, you know, Orwell is a hero in many ways to the left. He was a socialist in a certain sense. And they certainly like to tout him when it suits them. But he had a very good understanding of what he called the pansy left. And you see it in what's happened to the state of California, which has regulated itself out of existence, out of feasibility. You see it in New York City, where Mayor Bloomberg, a man who presumes to regulate the salt content of the meals of free-born citizens, cannot then get any salt on the roads because the sanitation department recognizes him as a member of the pansy left, a man who can regulate trans fats and regulate the salt content of meals, but is not going to do anything about their rapacious kleptocrat regime, or even do anything about them when they decide they're going to intentionally sabotage snow removal in a city emergency. You know, this is in effect the municipal equivalent of treason. This is like in a national emergency, your own military deliberately sabotaging the response to a national emergency. As I said, it's the municipal equivalent of treason. But the pansy left won't actually deal with real issues. It prefers to deal with fictitious problems, which are an opportunity for it to flaunt its moral vanity. The repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell is a classic example. Now, you think if you're one of America's enemies, or even America's friends, actually, you're sitting around in the presidential palaces around the world. You're sitting there in Moscow. You're sitting in Beijing. You're sitting in Pyongyang. You're sitting in Tehran. You're looking at the United States of America, a country with 10% unemployment, fighting two active wars, and the entire national political debate is about the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the House of Representatives and the United States Senate. It's an entirely fictitious problem. 85% of these people, they're not allowed to serve and be true to who they are, so they wind up having to leave the army. They're forced out of the army. 85% of the people who left under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, essentially volunteered to that they were gay to get out as a means of getting out of the army. It was basically some kind of, for those who remember the MASH TV show, they were pulling the old Corporal Klinger routine. As for actually being able to be openly gay in the army, Private First Class Manning, the guy who leaked all the WikiLeaks stuff by downloading them onto his Lady Gaga CD or whatever it was he did. This guy is basically some gay Welshman. I think his mother's Welsh and his father's American. And he joined the army. He's entirely openly gay. He had a Facebook page all the time he was leaking the WikiLeaks stuff and downloading it onto his Lady Gaga CD. He had a Facebook page moaning and whining about how he'd broken up with his boyfriend. There's no Don't Ask, Don't Tell there. He was telling the world. He was proclaiming it to the world in between leaking vital United States military secrets to the entire planet. So there never was a Don't Ask, Don't Tell in any meaningful sense of the world. Instead, it was an opportunity for moral narcissism on the part of the left. It's an opportunity to solve an entirely fictitious problem that gives you the chance to demonstrate your moral vanity. That's, by the way, the same with what's happened to Edison's light bulb. Banning Edison's light bulb isn't going to do anything to save the planet. It's going to make any difference to the planet. It's not going to make the what it does is enables the pansy left to demonstrate its moral vanity. But it imposes real costs on you. All these joke laws, the joke regulations, the pansy left solving these fictitious problems imposes huge real world costs. As you know, if you go to any website that's official Department of the Environment website that tells you how to deal with the new Curly Fry light bulb, the CFL, the Curly Fry light bulb that has replaced Edison's great iconic invention. This is from the Maine Department, State of Maine, the Department of Environmental Protection, Bureau of Remediation and Waste Management. What if I accidentally break a fluorescent lamp in my house? The lamp contains a small amount of mercury, but you can clean this up yourself if you do the following. Do not use a vacuum cleaner to clean up the breakage. This will spread the mercury vapor and dust throughout the area and could potentially contaminate the vacuum cleaner. Oh, what? Okay, right. So I can't just pick the broken light bulb up and stick it in the trash, and I can't use my vacuum cleaner either. Keep people and pets away from the breakage area until the cleanup is complete. Great, got it. My dog starts snuffling around it. The dog gonna die. Ventilate the area by opening windows and leave the area for 15 minutes before returning to begin the cleanup. Mercury vapor levels will be lower by then. Okay, so ventilate the area, open the windows, leave it for 15 minutes, get your pets out so they don't go snuffling around in all the mercury from the light. Okay, got it. So I take me, the grandma, the pets, we get us all out the house, open the windows, 15 minutes. For maximum protection, and if you have them, wear rubber gloves to protect your hands from the sharp glass. Got it. So after 15 minutes, with grandma and the pets outside, I got to go inside and find the rubber gloves, and that's fine, to throw away the light bulb. Carefully remove the larger pieces and place them in a secure closed container, preferably a glass container with a metal screw-top lid and seal like a canning jar. Ah, right. Okay, so I need rubber gloves and a canning jar when I re-enter the premises. Next, begin collecting the smaller pieces and dust. You can use two stiff pieces of paper, such as index cards or playing cards, to scoop up pieces. Okay, so I need rubber gloves, a canning jar, and a set of playing cards when I re-enter the contaminated premises. Pat the area with the sticky side of duct tape, packing tape, or masking tape to pick up fine particles. Wipe the area with a wet wipe or damp paper. Okay, I gotcha now. When I re-enter the premises, I need rubber gloves, I need a canning jar, I need a set of playing cards, and I need duct tape. Put all waste and materials into the glass container, including all material used in the cleanup as well. So you got to throw away your playing cards and your gloves and your duct tape and the canning jar too, and label the container as Universal Waste Broken Lamp. Remove the container with the breakage and cleanup materials. Continue ventilating the room for several hours. Wash your hands and face. Take the glass container with the waste material to a facility that accepts Universal Waste for recycling. So you can't toss it in the trash. You can't toss it in your regular town dump. You gotta take it to a special facility. When a break happens on carpet, homeowners may consider removing throw rugs or the area of the carpet where the breakage occurred as a precaution, particularly if the rug is in an area frequented by infants, small children, or pregnant women. Okay, so now aside from getting the gloves and the canning jar and the set of playing cards, you've now got to have a pair of scissors to cut up and remove the contaminated carpet from your floor. See how simple it is? Just 14 easy steps. With Edison's light bulb, if you break it, it's one easy step. You toss it in the trash. But according to the Maine Department of Environmental Protection, just 14 easy steps. All you need to keep handy are duct tape, playing cards, a canning jar, a sticky label to put on it. Who doesn't have those within easy reach of every electrical outlet? If the only canning jar you have, if you've got like a mason jar, but it's still got your pickles and berries in it, they also add, the Bureau of Remediation and Waste Management adds, You may need to empty it into another container before using it. I mean, don't ask me why. Are they just stating the obvious? Or will the mercury mutate with the content to create some giant toxic pickle that will rampage up the main coast all the way down east to Campobello Island, where it will pick up the Roosevelt summer retreat and crumple it like matchsticks and hurl it across the Bay of Fundy to Nova Scotia? I certainly hope so, because it would be hard to devise a more fitting end to the home of Franklin Roosevelt, the father of a big government, than ending up as a pile of worthless Canadian rubble. This is the official Department of Maine advice on what to do if you break a light bulb in America in the 21st century, culminating in don't forget to empty any pickled tomatoes or persimmon jelly you may have into another mason jar. And if you don't have another mason jar, so that's now two mason jars you need if you break a light bulb. And if you don't have another mason jar available, just empty the pickled tomatoes or the persimmon jelly onto the carpet, because as the Bureau of Remediation also tells us, you're going to have to throw the carpet out anyway. And any other fabrics that come into contact with the curly fry light bulb. What was that, Mr. Snerdley? Yeah, thank you, Fred Upton. Fred Upton, by the way, the new guy. This is the revolution of November the 2nd. We now have a strong conservative chairman of the relevant committee, House committee on this, and it's Fred Upton who believes in all this nonsense. All this nonsense. Throw away your carpet. You break a light bulb, throw away the carpet, throw away your canning jar, keep a bunch of playing cards. You can't, by the way, stick any contaminated clothes in the washer because, says the Environmental Protection Agency, mercury fragments in the clothing will contaminate the machine and pollute the sewage system. Right? Got that? So even if you do everything right, the little old lady next door who's 87 and perhaps isn't up to speed on the curly fry light bulb, maybe she'll just break a light bulb and she'll put the thing in the washer and it'll contaminate the sewage system. So only one thing can be said with certain, that the ensuing kidney and brain damage caused by this is going to make one hell of a class action lawsuit circa 2030. This is big government at work. It solved a problem that didn't need. There's nothing wrong with Edison's light bulb. It's the great iconic American invention, the great embodiment of American dynamism of the 19th century. And what did we do in the 21st century? We banned it. And as a result, every time you break a light bulb now, you need to have a mason jar, you need to have a set of playing cards, you need to have rubber gloves, you need to have throw mats, you need to empty out your persimmon jelly onto the contaminated carpet, and you're going to be at risk from a polluted sewage system. The pansy left solved a problem that didn't exist. Mark Stein in for Rush, more to come. Hey, this is the average white band, isn't it? Pick up the pieces. Don't even think about that if you break one of those curly fry light bulbs. Don't pick up the pieces. If the average white band were to remake this song today, it would be called Pick Up the Pieces, wearing rubber gloves and using a set of playing cards. Remember that. Don't try to pick up the pieces. Don't try this at home, folks. Mark Stein in for Rush on the EIB network, talking about some of the structural difficulties we face in the United States. Did you know this? In 1940, a majority of the U.S. population had no more than a grade 8 education. By 2008, 40% of 18 to 24-year-olds were enrolled in college. In other words, we're approaching the stage where the average American is twice as old by the time he completes his education as he was in 1940, and he spent over twice as long in the classroom and in theory gotten twice as much attention from his school mom, because the pupil-teacher ratio is half today of what it was a century ago. In fact, if you look at it since 1970, overall public school employment has increased 10 times faster than public school enrollment. In other words, the number of teachers has increased 10 times faster than the number of students, with no impact whatsoever on test scores. So 8th grade America, 1940, 8th grade America built America. Everything that dynamic about America was built by 8th grade America. The Edison's light bulb, the automobile, motion pictures, and all the great pop culture forms that America invented. And, of course, culminating, 8th grade America won the Second World War and established itself as the global hyperpower. 18th grade America over-credentialed America, over-regulated America, has driven America off the cliff. Think about that lost eighth-grade America. Think about that lost eighth-grade America that built this great republic. And then think about a world in which we stay in school till we're 30, stay in school till early middle age to get some ridiculous credentials so we can regulate all the great iconic American inventions out of existence. On that cheery note, let's go to Paul in Auburn, California. Paul, you're live on the Rush Limbaugh Show. Great to have you with us.
Happy New Year.
Say it more perkily. you say it like you're on suicide watch. Happy New Year. Happy
New Year.
We have
a very tall bridge over here.
Yeah. Well, that's the one good thing about California. It's got some great bridges to jump off.
Oh, yes. I noticed during Obama's campaign, at a certain point, I thought, it became pretty obvious to me. This man is running for Ayatollah, for a mullah, for a philosophical leader. And sure enough, it bears out. First thing he does is hands the nuts and bolts over to Pelosi and Reid and surrounds himself with academics. It's really playing out.
Yes, he's really a kind of supreme leader rather than an executive.
It would seem, yes.
And he had basically, as you said, for his first couple of years, he had basically Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid as co-prime ministers actually doing the day job, didn't he?
Yes. I mean, his input, and even his own wing of the party there, took exception to that. He's just not a hands-on guy. Like I said, a philosophical leader, supposedly. I think he got elected.
But let's unpack this a bit, Paul, because it's an interesting... People say this about Obama, that, yes, he is... Oh, it's great now that America doesn't have this embarrassing bozo like Bush, you know, with his Texan drawl and his swagger and brush cutting. You know, we now have this man who looks as if he's never broken a sweat in his life, the philosopher king. Mm. But what original thought? Tell me this. What original thought has this great philosopher king ever expressed?
Nothing really jumps out.
That's Obama all over. Nothing really jumps out.
No. Well, he's Reagan was always accused of being scripted, you know. Mm. And I think Barack it really is scripted. I notice his awkwardness outside of in press conferences and whatnot.
But you know the thing about Reagan? They always said that about him. In fact, mm-hmm. he had the most thought-through worldview any American president of modern times. Because long before he became president, he had spent a long time honing his political philosophy, seeing how it applied. So all this nonsense about him being scripted. By the way, I don't even like, I don't do a lot of TV, but when I do a lot of TV, I'm a little bit rusty about my teleprompter skills because I don't do a lot of it these days.
Yeah.
But one thing you notice is that somebody always types up a word or two wrong, or you change an adjective here, and there's some little glitch in there, and you see it coming up, and you get over it, and you move on, and you do it. What's fascinating about Obama is that some typed word in his teleprompter script brings him grinding to a halt, like that embarrassing thing giving Paul McCartney the Kennedy Center honors the other day. He basically read out six sentences in a row and got them all wrong. So he's not even a genius teleprompter reader. Now we're really scraping the bottom of Obama criticism. We're mocking his teleprompter skills. He's not the philosopher king. He's not even the teleprompter king. Thanks for your call, Paul. Mark Stein, InfraRush on the Rush Limbaugh Show, 1-800-282-2882. More to come. Yes, the 12 days of guest hosts or whatever it is continues, but we're getting near the day of liberation. Rush returns live Tuesday, January the 4th. Next Tuesday, live at 12 noon Eastern to kick off another year of excellence in broadcasting. So we're down to whatever we are now, the ninth day of guest host. And on the ninth day of guest hosts, Rush Limbaugh gave to me a guest host in a pear tree. It's not much longer. We'll be back with Rush live on Tuesday. I was just going through some of the listener email that's come in. David Masters wrote to me and says that I've quoted various Arabian proverbs And he wants to know, is there a good book full of them? There ought to be. There must be a book of Arabian proverbs now. I forget what the one is. What's the one I like? I think at the Arab League meeting just before the Iraq war, the foreign minister from the United Arab Emirates said it to the guy from Libya or whatever. Anyway, it's a very fractious meeting, and he said, "I fart at your beard," which is apparently the worst thing you can say in Arabic. So if you ever happen to be traveling at the Middle East, don't get, could you tell me the way to the bathroom with "I fart at your beard," because that is the worst insult you can ever do in Arabic. Let's go to Ray in Livermore, California. Ray, you are live on the Rush Limbaugh Show. Great to have you with us.
It's great to have you, Mark. You did job in place of Rush. I called to address the call from the last hour where the lady was talking about manufacturing in the U.S.
Right.
But real quick, I want to tell you, I've secured a 15-year supply of Edison light bulbs in my garage, so I'll be going a long time before
really?
They force me onto the new light bulb.
Okay, which part of California is Livermore in? Because I want to come by your house and break in and steal your light bulbs.
I'll be selling them for a profit many years down the road. I'm about 40 miles inland from San Francisco and San Jose, so I'm kind of triangulated to the inland territories. I call it the gateway to the red states.
Okay. Okay, but it's a real, because Livermore, New Hampshire, which is just up the road for me, is an unincorporated township. I think it's got a total population of one or two, and they're probably both wanted for an unsolved serial killings in other states, and that's why they've gone to Livermore to hang out. But you've got a real town there in Livermore, California.
You wanted
to talk about what Sherry was saying, I think, about manufacturing jobs.
Yes, sir. I have a friend, my friend Don, who has spent about $80,000 in developing a product and securing patents in order to bring this product to marketplace. And recently he was advised by the folks working with him that it's time to get a manufacturer online. And so
right.
he immediately set up a trip to China. And he wanted to manufacture this product here in the States, but he was told simply, you can't do it.
Now, why can't he do it in the United States?
Well, the cost of the product to meet a price point that folks would buy, you simply can't employ Americans or Californians. The environmental regulations, this is if I'm not mistaken, it's a product that's manufactured from plastic, and so environmental concerns and what
right.
The manufacturing plants that could handle this work were all located in China.
Right, right. And this is a common story now, that in fact there is still great inventiveness in the United States, but the price of hiring U.S. citizens to do this work is too high. Government imposes a surcharge on the cost of hiring Americans, as we were talking about yesterday when I was talking about the surcharge that the state of New York and the city of New York imposes on me for hiring a New Yorker. You don't get that if you're hiring people not just in China, but in Sweden or in Ireland or even in a socialist basket case like the province of Quebec. This is something that is becoming a huge problem in America, the surcharge that government imposes on hiring Americans. And then the other point you make, which is that the regulation involved in any factory or mill or industrial enterprise in the United States, even if you can get the approval to build a new factory, and even saying those words feels slightly unreal these days, the regulatory burdens imposed on you in the state make it much you would have to be insane not to say, to hell with this, let's open the factory in China, wouldn't you?
There you go. It's the very same people who are crying out that American businesses are not hiring, the same people who are mad at corporations for offshoring jobs, the very people who are causing these things to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what this is? H.G. Wells wrote about this in his novella, The Time Machine, 1893. A guy is in Victorian London. He hops on a time machine and he goes 800,000 years into the future. And that's the only thing H.G. Wells got wrong about it, because the world he predicted showed up 799,999 years ahead of schedule. He foresaw a society where there were the effete decadent Eloi, and you can barely tell man from woman They've abolished gender. They all have the same soft skin. And somewhere out of sight doing everything is this underground people called the Morlocks. And that's basically what your great state of California has done. You've got these effete, sexless Eloi who run your state, and they have moved everything out of sight. They don't realize that the lives they live depend on industrial labor. Depend on people making things, doing things. The beautiful granite countertops that Californians have in their homes, that has to be quarried. A granite quarry has to quarry that granite to make those beautiful countertops. And nobody among the American Eloi, this effete, pansy left ruling class, wants to see any of this stuff going on. So as a result, it's all done out of sight. It's all done either by the legions of the undocumented, doing the minimum wage labor in the United States, or it's been outsourced to factories overseas. It's H.G. Wells' vision, showed up 799,999 years ahead of schedule, Ray. But I'll tell you something else too. And this is why America doesn't quite seem like it did in Edison's day. You think of the great inventions that were made in the first half of the 20th century, and then you look at the last 50 years, you know, what was the last big medical breakthrough? You know, big in the sense of something that takes a huge crippling worldwide disease that we've accepted as a cruel fact of life and clobbers it so we don't even give it a thought anymore. Because that's what the polio vaccine did in 1955. People used to worry about polio and nobody even gives a thought to polio now. It's gone away. Why haven't we done that for Alzheimer's? You know, today we've got all these races for the cure. I was on a flight the other day, and they asked us to donate an extra $5 or whatever for on some little flight, commuter flight, donate an extra $5 to a race for the cure. I forget what it was for now. I don't even remember. It was for breast cancer, and we all do it, but we know nobody's going to cure breast cancer. All we're doing is tossing money into the bucket so they can print up some more colored ribbons. We got a color. Every color ribbon has been taken for the race for the cure. We got pink ribbons for breast cancer. We got gray ribbons for brain cancer. We got white ribbons for bone cancer. We've got yellow ribbons for adenosarcoma. That's true, by the way. We've got light blue ribbons for Addison's disease. We've got teal ribbons for agoraphobia. We have had phenomenal breakthroughs in hues of awareness raising ribbons. Yet for all the raised awareness, very few people seem aware of how the whole disease-curing business has absolutely ground to a halt in the United States. You compare the 1920s to the 1990s. In the 1920s, the discovery of insulin, penicillin, first vaccines for tuberculosis, diphtheria, tetanus, whooping cough, on and on and on and on. In the last decade of the 20th century, we got Viagra. And the decline hasn't stopped. The number of approvals by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has halved in the last decade. So you can be an innovator in this country and see where it gets you. See where it gets you. You can try to develop a new cure. You can try to develop a new device. You can try to develop something that might employ a lot of people if you put up a factory to build it. But all you do is to begin the government approval process is to enter what researchers in America today call the Valley of Death. We are seizing up as a society because of the burdens of government regulation, Ray. And that is why your friend, developing his product, winds up going and actually manufacturing it in factories in China because of the cost of hiring American citizens, the burdens of regulation, and even getting the government approval to exploit your economic potential to its full potential. Edison, had he been around today, Edison would have gone and opened up the factory in China and quit wasting his time in the United States of America. That's the tragedy of the U.S. story since the 19th century. Mark Stein in for Rush, 1-800-282-2882. Gordon sends me an interesting email. How many curly fry light bulbs must a terrorist flush down the toilet to kill one American? You know, I hope the Transport Security Administration is onto that, because I think we need enhanced pat downs before you enter the restroom at an American airport, just to check that you're not going down there to flush some curly fry light bulb down the toilet, because you could do untold damage to the health of millions of Americans by doing that. So I hope the TSA has got some enhanced pat-down that will, check whether you've got anything hidden amidst your church, amidst your short and curlies when you're going into the men's room in the at Newark Airport. It's important to stay on top of that, and I hope the TSA are taking care of it. Let's go to Chuck in Vail, Arizona. Chuck, thank you. You've been waiting a long time, and we're glad you stuck with us. Welcome to the Rush Limbaugh Show.
Happy New Year, Mr. Stein. It's an honor to speak with you.
Happy New Year to you, too, Chuck.
My question is regarding your book, America Alone, which is also a great book. I recommend it to anyone who would like to read it. My copy
okay.
is soon to be banned in Canada. I was just wondering if they were successful with that.
Actually, we were acquitted in British Columbia, so it's still legal to read my book in Canada, but it's very unrespectable. I was in a bookstore in Washington when the book came out, and I saw somebody. It was the Playboy book of celebrity nudes, and somebody shuffled back and forth past this book once or twice, and then bought the Playboy book of celebrity nudes, and then picked up a copy of America Alone to slide on top of the Playboy book of celebrity nudes to cover their embarrassment of being seen with it. But it would be the other way around in Canada. If you're buying America Alone, pick up the Playboy book of celebrity nudes to cover up the embarrassing copy of Mark Steyn's hate crime that you're taking out of the bookstore with you. I mean, not just for that. It's also got some great pictures of Nancy Sinatra in there. So, I can't complain. Anyway, Chuck... back to your point about the book, Vail from Vail.
My point is, your premise, and correct me if I'm wrong, states that basically there's a birth blitz in Europe among people of the Muslim persuasion, and that this is happening all over the world. The demographics right. is shifting toward the Muslim side of the equation. Right. And I was wondering, you also compared the United States and stated that we had a favorable demographic for American native-born citizens in relation to Muslim populations in the United States. Well, my question is, did your research in that point have any bearing on whether or not illegal immigrants who are predominantly Roman Catholic and have large families contribute to the ramparts of demographic defense that we have here?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that illegal aliens are responsible for a significant contribution to the birth rate in the United States. I mean, there are some hospitals where up to 70% of babies born in those hospitals are so-called anchor babies. That's to say they're the children of illegal immigrants. There's a hospital in Dallas. There's a town in California. And that changes the demographic picture. If you look at, for example, Arizona, people say go on about this law, but in a sense the law has come along extremely late. A majority of children in the Arizona grade schools are already of Hispanic origin, so Arizona's future is as an Hispanic society. That is a given. Who your grade school population is who you're going to be. If you take the Brussels school system, at the grade school level, this is supposedly a Catholic country, but at the grade school level, more children identify as Muslim now as Catholic. So in the Antwerp school system and in other Belgian cities, those cities' future is as Muslim societies. Who your grade school population is who you're gonna be in the future, and who Arizona's grade school population is Hispanic. So it's going to be a Hispanic society. Maybe it'll work out, maybe it won't, but that's pretty much a given. So I find it interesting that people do demographic analysis in the United States of tiny little shifts. You know, they say, well, well, this particular Colorado suburb has seen an influx of so many soccer moms with college degrees over the last 10 years, and that presents difficulties for this or that candidate. But they're very wary about actually looking at it in terms of big picture demographic changes and big picture demographic changes. I mean, we've seen a transformation in America, essentially with a category that didn't even exist in the 1960 census. In the 1960 census, there was no such thing as Hispanic. Now it's a majority in the school systems of jurisdictions across the southwest of the United States. So demography is the answer to it. Look at your demography, look at your nurseries, look at your grade schools, look at your middle schools. That's who you're going to be in 10, 15 years' time.
So the good thing is, I suppose, that there won't be anybody walking around with a bomb strapped around their waist.
Well, if you're trying to look at it in an optimistic, the glass is 1/16 full kind of way, Chuck, it's easier to import a population Latin American, a poorly educated Latin American population, than it is to import a poorly educated Muslim population who regard you as filthy, decadent, unclean infidels, who raise their women as whores, and whose society you'd like to blow up. Yes, obviously, in crude terms, that's better, but at the same time, it's going to be transformative. Thanks for your call. We got to run. We got to take an EIB profit center here, but we'll be back with more on the Rush Limbaugh Show straight after this. Mark Stein in for Rush on the EIB network. First prize is one guest host. Second prize is two guest hosts. We have two guest hosts Thursday for you. Joining me in the next hour will be the guest host of guest hosts, the great Walter E. Williams. He has a new book out called Up From the Projects, which is, everyone has heard Walter talking macroeconomic theory. This is macroeconomic theory applied to Walter's own life, the story of how he got himself up from the projects. Up next on the Rush Limbaugh Show.